House Judiciary Committee, February 23rd, Room 350, Subcommittee A, Joint Hearing with House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Order. For the record, this is a joint meeting of the Subcommittee of the House Committee on Judiciary and the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources to hear House Bill 2096. Mr. Hershey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Committee, I'm Walt Hershey, Oregon State Police, Major in charge of the Game Enforcement Division. I think probably I should take a few moments and review a little history in that 2096 isn't a new notion in this session. Last session, we supported a bill aimed at commercial lots of fish. We were having, and still are having, considerable problems on the Columbia River. Cost of fish rapidly increasing, the incentive was there, and a number of people that were willing to take advantage of the opportunity. I might explain that one example I cited before of a fellow that was willing to talk about his operation. This was prior to an open season, which of course is a choice time to get in and cream the run before it, the other legal fishery takes place. He had his gear in the water 40 minutes, and we sold his fish. I don't recall now whether it was a dollar or two more or less than $1,000, but it does demonstrate that you can make in the neighborhood of $1,000 in less than an hour, which beats robbing banks. We had other catches of $3,000 to $4,000 worth of fish in a night. Okay, we felt that getting up in that magnitude, that it would certainly justify being a Class C felony. And a separate bill was introduced. At the same time, we developed problems which you're probably familiar with our mule deer herds. And several of, this appealed to several of the legislators from Eastern Oregon. They saw this as a remedy to provide some relief, an added penalty on diminishing mule deer herds, which turned out to be sort of a biological thing, and it's on the upswing again. We're not in that much trouble now. But in any event, it was a separate bill was introduced on big game animals. 2096, incidentally, includes both activities, the commercial fish and big game animals, as being class, probable class C felonies. In the process of things moving around here, even though the fish bill was introduced first, the one involving big game animals reached the floor sometime ahead of the fishery bill. And I don't recall who carried it. They did a good job of presenting it, but it caught another legislator a little short on the, who hadn't had a chance to listen to any of the testimony, and he stood up and made a dramatic plea against it. And I don't dispute his rationale either. He said, here, I have constituents that have their alfalfa fields ravished, eaten into the ground, and then on up into the carrot patch, and finally mother's roses, and in a moment's frustration, the farmer sticks his gun out the window and shoots it, and now you guys want to send him to the penitentiary. Needless to say, the game bill flunked miserably. And this caused a lot of concern then on the fishery end of it. Went back to committee, and some stronger penalties were created, but it was left as a Class A misdemeanor. I think we should have done a little more homework and made a presentation, which I intend to show you today, and explain how we envision using it. And those of you with legal background, I think we're going to need some more help on this thing, another item or two that I'll talk about when I come to it. But for the moment, I would like to show you some slides and sort of explain how we envision using Class C felony if it becomes reality. Okay, hardly a game animal, but that day-old calf in the foreground there, I look in this morning's paper, they have them for $10-$15 a piece. And yet it's a Class C felony if you steal one of them. And I'm not putting that down at all. I think that in the wisdom of the legislature, they recognize that the rancher's investment is scattered around in the hinterland and such as that, and vulnerable to thieves. and it should have this additional protection of a Class C felony. When the code was recodified, you'll recall, the value came back into it. It had to be $200 or more of value, the same as other felonies. Well, obviously that cap isn't worth $200, so it would have been a misdemeanor. And I guess it was last session that was rectified, and larceny of livestock per se became a Class C misdemeanor again. All right, my philosophy is that our game animals, and some that are in real trouble from time to time, are exposed to the same elements and the same people creeping around out there preying on the game animals. We find quite typically a cattle thief is, generally speaking, a game violator as well. All right. Here's how the average operation takes place. I'll show you some more examples a little later. The results of this, there's a couple of deer standing in the spotlight. I've done this myself. You can, if you're quiet, move quietly, you can walk right up. They're just paralyzed, hypnotized there, so you can see what easy prey they are. I've walked up and actually poked one with my finger. I don't recommend this because you never know which way they're going to unravel when they get that contact, but nevertheless, it shows you how vulnerable the animals are. All right, here's a product of a night hunting expedition, too, which is very typical, something we run onto right along, because rarely does an animal fall right in its tracks. They'll get to a stop in an alfalfa field, shoot, it jumps out of the light. They don't want to spend too much time there. They've already disturbed the silence, so they don't fall completely dead immediately. They continue on down the road looking for another one, and then the next day you'll find a bloated animal like this. Now, let's say we make a case on that. This is the example I want to make as I move along here. Fair enough. Generally speaking, we'd say a Class A misdemeanor. But if we put a case together on this fellow, and now we find out, and here's a judgment matter, one that's a problem we'll have to deal with, but let's say he's been had 3, 4, maybe 5. A lot of the people we're dealing with have been arrested any number of times. I think then we should start taking a look at him. We can show you some of the other things that happen as a result of spotlighting livestock. So maybe he should be confronted with a Class C felony joke if the prior trips to court haven't cured anything. Here's a typical operation of somebody in a hurry. They take the choice pieces of meat. It's another spotlight situation, just rapidly whack off the hams and back strap and get on with it and leave the rest of the spoil. There again, if we put a case together on a fellow that's had a history of doing some of this before, I think the decision should be made that he tried on the Class D felony. Here's the product of an illegal sale operation in a community. There's remnants of 8 deer that we found in a fellow's garage. There's 3 involved in this. Spotlighting, as I showed you earlier, all these deer killed at night. We're selling them. He also had a beef animal, half or three quarters of a beef animal that we couldn't identify the owner. But we know he didn't have any. He obviously stole it someplace, but we could never find the owner. We lodged him in jail. The next day they received a sentence of 3 days in jail. And the judge gave him credit for the one day they'd already been detained, suspended the other 2 days, and they were back out on the street. This was a situation of community involvement. Citizens became real disturbed and really raised a fuss about it, and the same court that did that is responding far better since this situation. Here's a product of another sale situation in a neighboring county here. 5 deer out of 1 car, and of course they were engaged in this too. Sell a load of deer like that to buy a little Bull Durham sack full of pot or something. Here's a situation from the Russian community out here. We have quite a problem with them for some reason or other. They keep talking about persecution, but they don't want to comply with any of the laws, and I think that's probably why they moved a few times. But Here's another, I'll show you another example. We're not picking on them. They're just a handful of slides that came up. They had the deer look a little soggy there. They detected this officer's presence in the area somewhere or another. Saw his lights or whatever, the knife. He shook them down. They had all the paraphernalia, but no animals. He later, by tracking, following some blood spots and one thing and another, found these clear under a beaver dam. They'd gone to all the, that's probably why they were so clean. The two that had handled the deer also were submerged, getting these deer shoved down and up in a den of a beaver dam. Made the case on them the next day. All a spotlight situation again. This is just a scenery shot that shows what we're after. Now, we've had situations here, a lot of very time-consuming, costly to trap and transplant elk to start them in areas where we have habitat but no animals. Cost the Wildlife Commission a considerable amount of money to conduct these transplants. We've made little plants to 5-6 animals one day and have one or two shots the very next day. Little plants down here at Newport that occurred. They killed two of them the next day after they were planted. Here's a situation where they walked, for what reason, I don't suppose we ever will find out. We do have specimens, bullets out of 7 elk. People walked in the snow 4 miles from the nearest road, shot 7 elk, stuffed them full of snow and left. We, of course, examined them, got bullets out of them. Here again, if this is a situation where, especially if it's somebody with a prior record, by all means, we feel that Class C felony should come into play. Here's another just promiscuous willful shooting south of God's Valley here in Yamhill County. 7 elk just shot and left. You can see they're pretty ripe there. You'll notice the officer with a plastic on his arms. By the time they get to this state of decomposure, they, if you have the slightest little scratch or anything, it's very infectious. It's nauseating work, but just talked to the officer. There's a better shot of him right here, the one using the metal detector. Incidentally, that saves us a lot of time. We do have quite a collection of bullets out of the 7 animals and may still make this case. Here again, it's my contention, when you consider a potential value of, even the civil value that's placed on them is $300 a piece. Times 7, you're talking about $2,100 worth of animals that he just destroyed. Shot, left leg, didn't take a pound of meat. And there's no agricultural crops involved or anything. It was just malicious destruction. As I say, we still may make this case even though it occurred last July. There's 4 elk and 4 deer shot in close season down in Washington County, again in the Russian community. Example of what goes on. Show that only because we made our first bighorn sheep case just about 2 weeks ago. They've been to court. These, again, were transplanted at quite a cost to the state and are starting to produce in a few areas. And this is the first one we know of that was shot in close season. We didn't make the case, and the judge got a little huffy about that. He fined them $500 in costs apiece and took their paraphernalia and their hunting rights for 2 years. Actually, here again, one of the purposes of talking about a Class C felony is to attract the attention of some of the judges that regard hunting and fishing violations as just sort of a boyish prank. Others that are involved, hunt and fish themselves, and recognize the value of our natural resources, which this judge does, impose penalties that, if it was all uniform, chances are we wouldn't be here talking to you about this. All right, it only doesn't occur with game animals. There's 13 black Angus, the remnants of 13 black Angus animals that were just maliciously shot by some juveniles. We got it put together, and I think the ultimate outcome, Dad got the checkbook out and settled with the property owner. Now there again, of course, well, we're not talking about game animals here, but for the moment, if we were and this was youngsters, that's fine. But
again, if it was somebody that had fouled a time or two for big game violations before and created a mess with game animals like that, here's where we again think that the Class C felony should come into play. We do quite a bit of work with aircraft, primarily, in, well, all sorts of things, but we make a lot of night hunting cases, which I didn't think would be that successful, but we've actually been able to observe the deer in the light, see the muzzle blast out of the car, watch the deer fall, and the guy run to it. Not long ago, we had a fellow that he figured something went wrong and got out of the area. Didn't take the deer. We apprehended him. No, he wasn't anywhere near that place. And our observer in the plane, blow by blow, described his actions, where the deer was standing, and he says, when you crawled over, and he didn't have it with him. He said, where's that yellow dog you had with you? He said, what dog? The one that got tangled up between your feet going through the fence when you was going over to get the deer. He said, that's enough for me. I didn't realize anybody could see all that. This is all observed from the air. Road closures, here again, we have 48 in the state that are designed to take the stress off of wintering animals. We do other things while we're in there. If we see stray beef animals left behind, some when they're rounding up, they miss some of them, we report them. It's just a kind of a public interest shot, but some of the work that we do with the aircraft. And here again shows how we handle the road closures. We'd never be able to deal with them just using ground equipment. There's so many of them, they're so large, but with the aircraft, we're able to cover them real well, provide all sorts of enforcement effort. There's a vehicle that stopped because he has suspected of having stolen timber products, shake material, shake bolts. And the officer stopped him. I noticed the wood pile had a bloody nose. There was a couple deer under it. Here's a case still pending, a beautiful crown elk. And I think this makes a good example. I don't like to talk about that too much, mm-hmm. but the case is still pending. Justice doesn't always move too rapidly. This was shot early last deer season. It was a calculated situation. These four guys knew it was there and they wanted the trophy. And that's really all they intended to take. But a deer hunter spooked them, so they got out of the area. And but we were able to get on it. We salvaged the animal, whatever that's worth, and apprehended the fellows, but we couldn't get that scheduled for trial until late next May. This is one of the problems we have, too, which certainly making a coyote felony isn't going to speed it up any, but people move out of the state, forget, die, and whatever, and quite often a beautiful case like that just goes down the tube. But I didn't tend to say if these fellows that are involved in this, if they have a prior record on that type of thing, certainly I feel that they should go the Class C felony route. Here's a deer that was just maliciously shot during elk season because an elk hunter wanted some back strap to go with his hotcakes. Unfortunately, don't have the head with a beautiful trophy, 4-point buck. Well, that's just outright wanton waste and maliciousness, and I think he should be severely dealt with. It's still pending, too. He's pled not guilty. Here's another similar thing. We made a case on it, and that's been tried. Here's just part of a salvage operation, which gives us nothing. It looks like the problems are over when you get to that point, but ironic, and just a point of interest, one of our biggest problems is disposing of this meat. We used to furnish the schools and county jail, but now, since we're not wearing rubber gloves and pushing on a cement floor and stainless steel tubs and all this, we can't supply it to any institution that has federal money in it. So the problem isn't over when we get to this point. There's some fellows that are good shots but can't count. Here's a, so we'll get into a few fishery shots. That's a net you see there taken out of our aircraft. It's probably 300 feet long. Once while we were restrained during the cloudier days of the Indian fishery in the Columbia River, all we could do was sit and watch. We watched one Indian pull three nets that size, 100 yards or less, and we were estimating his K cash, figured it was around $4,000, and that's when fish were considerably cheaper back in the mid-60s. Later in the day, we found out he sold them over to Stevens from Washington to a dealer there for over $4,000. So that shows you the capability of the so-called gill net. I think I should mention before I forget it here, too, the industry supported Class D felony in the last session. Representative Bugis was involved. I know he strenuously supported it because there's only a very small nucleus of people that are doing it. So there's people that have fished their entire lifetime in the Columbia River that we don't even know. When the season's open, they fish, they're straight-laced, they're honest, hard-working people, and they're fed up with this little group of people that moved into it. They're just naturally criminals. Two fellows on the river that were arrested over 20 times. And then, as I say, there's others that have fished the river their entire life, and we don't even know them, simply because they're doing things right. But they're fed up with this publicity that about a half a dozen people are giving the entire occupation, if you will. This is just simply pulling a post-season net. Most of our activity is at night, too, I should mention. We work well over 300 miles of the Columbia River, and it's pitch dark. Just simply, we do have radar on a couple boats. They help some, but it's still an awful lot of area. As I mentioned, people can put in, get in and out in an hour and pick up $1,000 worth of fish. The incentive is there, and we have those that are going to take advantage of it. This is a situation that occurred in the lower river. And I wouldn't want to be locked into one of two situations, but I think this is one where we spooked the fellow in the middle of the night. Of course, it's in close season, and that's a drift net, 1,500 feet in length. He ran off, and somehow in the fog or whatever, our people did not find the net till the following day, late the following day, or maybe even a day later. It had drifted on down and got hung up down towards the mouth. But there was 10,000 pounds, we estimated, 5 ton of fish in the net. The fall, when the water temperatures are up, fish were all sour, couldn't sell any of them. Well, that demonstrates the capability or what can be destroyed in a comparatively short period of time. There's a fellow that if he'd have gotten by with it, he was $10,000 richer. Again, he lost the net, the fish, but it's still a terrific waste of the resource. This gives you an idea how cheaply you can get into it. These fellows that I mentioned, we've arrested somewhere around 20 times apiece. Of course, they usually steal their boats. But in any event, here's close to probably $700-$800. I recall it was about $800 worth of salmon in that boat. There's quite a few in the bow you're not seeing. And that's just one night's catch. Well, he could replace that whole outfit for that kind of money, the boat, the motor, well, probably not the net, but in one night fishing, the profit from one night, he's back in business and has the potential of making pretty good money. We had one situation where, and they use all everything to protect themselves. They usually have a lookout on it. They set a net. One will stay fairly close to it with a Mickey Mouse two-way radio. Binoculars, tin of binoculars, where they can see pretty good at night. First sign of any noise or hear us in the area. Of course, they alert the ones that are standing by in the boat who would eventually come in and run the net, and they leave. Well, we picked half of a brand new drift net that had been stolen in Portland, 1,500-foot net. One night, down at Warrior Rock off of Sobeys Island, the lookout ran off, left the binoculars and the coat and some other things, managed to get in the boat and leave. We had to go a considerable distance around a point of land to get up to where, of course, we didn't know the net was there, but when this disturbance started, we went and looked into it and found the net. All right. We never did get these two guys that night, but the next night we arrested them in a completely different area. I think that was clear up at Corbett, and fish started building up under the Bonneville Dam. And here's the other half of that net. Everything matched up. We could do this sixth pen in our lab. For some reason or other, the district attorney wouldn't prosecute for the theft of the mint. They claimed they found it or whatever. And as I recall in that caper, they got out of it for little or nothing. There again, just pulling the net down the lower river. That's one of our pieces of equipment in the boat. You'll notice the radar on top. And it is helpful when we're working out there at night. We can see movement. Of course, it steers you into logs and other things, too. But it's still pretty tedious work when you consider that we have, as I mentioned, something over 300 miles of river to work. And then they pop into Washington, where they can avoid us. Some of those junker boats, they'll just leave them run on shore in Washington. And of course, we're a little shy on authority over there, so that makes the situation a little more complex. Litter shot got in there. This shows that archers can occasionally be a pain in the cow's right rear ham, too. We're having more and more trouble with archers. This was a situation at night. It's pretty deadly, too, because you don't even have the noise to contend with. This cow, of course, the calf wouldn't leave her, had to go to the vet with her. They pulled the arrow out, got her sewed up, and she lived. I put that one in there for Denny Jones. I thought he'd be interested. Okay, that ends the slides here, and if I would like to make one comment that I see as a concern with the bill, and that is, okay, we make, in this category, something like 1,400 cases a year that, based on 2096, could conceivably be Class C felony. Well, certainly we don't envision pursuing that many. I'm talking about in the commercial fishery, for an example, on the river, if two or three went out to the penitentiary in the first year or so, I'd be surprised. I envision most of them being put on prohibition, but in any event, here they're still under the jurisdiction of corrections. They've indicated there'd be some financial impact as far as they're concerned. That they were looking, they thought we were going to be marching some 1,200 people out to the penitentiary. I don't envision that at all. I have Lieutenant Atchison from our traffic division with us, and you may want to talk to him a little bit about the experience they've had with the felony bill on traffic. This is on chronic offenders, drunk drivers, you're probably familiar with it, and habitual driving while suspended and this type of thing. They tell me that
what was the total, Marv, that wound up in the penitentiary on that? Why don't you come up here, they may have some questions. This is Lieutenant Atchison of our traffic division.
The 1975 legislature enacted provisions in the revised criminal code to provide for a felony type of traffic offense for driving while suspended based on convictions for certain prior offenses, namely criminal negligent homicide or manslaughter, or any crime punishable as a felony in which a motor vehicle is used for any one of the serious traffic offenses. If the suspension was based on that reason, and the person was detected riding while suspended, then he could be prosecuted for a Class C felony. At the present time, there's been 10 persons since July 1 of 76 sentenced to either the penitentiary or OCI. And they have quite lengthy driving records and quite often lengthy criminal records.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so my concern here is, looking at it from the prosecution point of view, and looking at this pertains to drugs, and whether we could develop different language, crank it into this, I'd have to rely on the legal minds among you. I've talked to Chuck Wilson a little bit. and he really hasn't had the time to research it, but what I'm a little apprehensive about is, I mentioned we have a potential of 1,200 cases, that we would find ourselves having to prosecute as a felony. You can imagine, this would eliminate a lot of the cop-outs. With a felony rap, we'd be spending a lot more time in court. I would like to somehow know that we were going to proceed as a Class C felony. Let's refer to that big pile of fish there. I'd like to go into that as a Class C felony and come out of it as a Class C felony. Not then, which 161705 says that the judge at the time of sentencing can determine whether he wants to sentence under a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony. Well, after you've rolled up your sleeves and slugged it out clear to the bitter end, and you think you have the components of a good Class C felony, then to have the judge fold his tent and go on a Class A misdemeanor, well, we might be defeating what we're trying to accomplish here, I guess is what I'm saying. Unless, through the wisdom of somebody that has a better handle on this than I, can figure out a way around that.
You said there were 1,200 to 1,400 cases a year
that would
prosecuted for violation, or that would be converted to Class C felonies under this.
Yeah, we make runs between all around 12,000 cases total a year. This is angling license and everything. Out of that, about 10% or 1,200 would qualify in what we've been talking about here, big game cases.
Under this bill?
Yes, sir. And commercial fish cases.
Now, those are all Class A misdemeanor cases now?
Yes, sir.
And what... Do you maintain any kind of statistics on the, or data on what's happening in those cases? How many are dismissed? How many are...
Yes.
Pleas are taken in?
We do, but our statistics are not accurate for this reason. We have a pretty real good conviction rate, but when you look at the raw statistics, our conviction rate isn't too sharp because we have bordering states. People fishing Il Huaco, out of Il Huaco, non-appearances is what I'm saying, from other states. Well, they'll lay around a while, and then finally they'll dismiss the whole bunch, and of course they go down as acquittals, which reflects on our conviction rate. Indian cases, all of a sudden they'll decide to start a new day and dismiss all of those, and again, this has an impact on our conviction rate. Our mean end of the year actual conviction rate is about 92%.
And what... It's a typical sentence being imposed. Is there some pattern that's developing?
It fluctuates drastically, and the legislature last session directed Bob Holloway of the Wildlife Commission to do a study on the courts to show Representative Byers can tell you we have endless reams of testimony here of citizens complaining about low penalties. Well, the survey that was done indicated that some of the courts are imposing pretty substantial penalties. Others are, let me give you one example.
Pretty substantial. What does that mean?
Okay, on a spotlighting case, we feel pretty satisfied with, again, if it's the first offense, 250. Some of the judges are saying 500. Others are saying 25. We had one situation on two lots of illegal fish bought in closed season. And incidentally, the people that are attracted to that, for the most part, are restaurants. We've arrested practically every major hotel. I'm offending somebody here, but in any event, a lot of the major hotels have been buying them. They have storage facilities half the size of this room. And let's say we have a season in February. Okay, they will have bought some legal fish then. Or they can go down to a legal fish company and buy them too, right along, frozen, sharp frozen. But if they have an opportunity to go down in the middle of the night and buy a couple tons of fish, they're going to cost them $2 through legitimate sources. And they can buy them from a bootleg fisherman for a dollar. Some of these percentage-conscious chefs are going to go down and open it up. But once they're sharp frozen, we see fish that in our own judgment, we know were taken just a few days prior. One, in this situation, example I'm going to cite for you, there'd been a season in February, that particular year. Okay, and this was just prior to the late April or early May spring run that everybody gets pretty panicky about. There's quite a few fish in the river already, but they still don't know what the counts over Bonneville are. Not substantial enough that they can permit an open season. Well, this attracts quite a few people to start fishing, hauling them to storage someplace, and then when the season does open, they move out onto the market. Well, this restaurant bought these two batches of approximately 1,500, well, it was a total of 3,000 pounds of fish. We had two cases on him. Of course, he pled not guilty immediately. But these are, and this is about the middle of April, so these are still fish from February. Well, we examined the fish a little more closely and found monitoring devices on them that the Wildlife Commission put on at Bonneville Dam to check the progress of the migration and their data. They'd only been on the fish about 4 days. Well, armed with this knowledge, then he sent his attorney up and plea bargained a little bit. Plea bargained one case away, pled guilty on the other, was fined $25, and the $3,000 worth of fish returned fine. So this is... there's all sorts of examples that we can cite, up, down, in between. It's not very consistent, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Is anybody serving any jail time?
Occasionally, but that's quite limited.
The question I have is that, and I think Representative Myers was getting at this, that trying to find out how much time that a person is spending incarcerated because of these offenses. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, if in fact that the idea is just to scare them, and we really don't think anybody's going to get locked up over it, I don't know why we're messing around with a Class C felony. Now, I'm unclear as to what your objective is of how you think that we can some way help you prevent the examples that we've been seeing shown today. Is it going to take a jail sentence, or is it going to take a higher fine? You know, that there's other ways, that, and I'm not advocating this, but it's, I don't think you need a Class C felony if you think that people need to be locked up. I think that you can just put some mandatory limits on it and attempt it that way. Time. But I'm not sure from your testimony you think that would accomplish your objective. Or is it a financial one that you think the way to handle this thing is just get them into a spot where it's going to cost them much more than they can ever benefit economically out of what they're doing?
Well, two things. This was our intent. I envisioned this accomplishing what you're saying on the fishery end of it. And you'll recall, this was our thrust last session, and still is. Other interests, one of the game animals included. Now, I think it's probably, while we support the whole program, I think it's more important than that we have it on the fishery, on the commercial fish.
Do you think the money aspect, though, the fine, is more important than the person doing jail time?
My personal experience has been that the jail time stops them more than the financial end of it. These fellows that I mentioned that we've had over and over and over, they make that back, whatever, and then some, fine, the next night. But as I was doing 10 days in jail, at least a few fish would get by.
That's what I wanted to know.
For the members of information with some of that committee, last interim, our committee went, we held two meetings, one at the Dalles and one at Astoria, where we invited the judges, district attorneys, who else, in the area. In fact, we had one of the judges came up from Lane County, which, by the way, Representative Coon Josh here is one of the guys that's really doing some, you know, really getting tough on the violators down there. We had some JPs. We had a Lady Justice Peace from over at Tillamook County, I believe, who was a little bit apprehensive when she was asked to come. She thought maybe that we were going to say something about her being as tough as she is. But believe me, in that particular case, the lady was doing the kind of a job that we, I think, if all the rest of the individuals, the judges around the state were doing the kind of job she was, we wouldn't have been here worried about this now, because you can almost bet that they, if they go before her, they're going to spend some time in the slammer if they violated. And, of course, she's reduced the problems in that area tremendously. I don't know what the percentage is, but people are very well aware of what the penalties are going to probably be if they're apprehended there. Then I followed that up with a meeting that I spoke to the Oregon Association of District Judges down in Cottage Grove. And after I'd spoken to them and got to dialogue going between afterwards, the questions and answer period, the consensus had been, of course, a lot of them, that the judges had not really taken these game violations and the protection of the resource very seriously. Some of them did participate. We, in fact, is on our tour to go back up just a little bit. When we were up in the Dalles and then over to Astoria, we had one Multnomah County judge who followed us. He participated at the hearing at the Dalles, then he went the following day, and he was over at Astoria, and he really was concerned because he had been taking a lot of these violations rather lightly. One of the things that came up on several occasions was the thing that Major Hershey had related to, that of course if you don't have if you don't have customers, for instance for the illegal fish, then that doesn't make it as attractive to catch them. So the hitting the some of the hotels and some of the better hotels, I must say, or at least the ones that carry a pretty high rating in the city of Portland have been guilty of purchasing these. We have, you know, done everything we could to, and we did pass some legislation in the last session on their recording and having to have receipts to show where they purchased the fish. There's a number of things that we have worked on in the past, and I guess it just takes a combination of efforts and laws, apparently, to get this thing brought under control. And that's one reason, Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate the chance to hold this jointly with your committee, because I figured, well, one thing, of course, that there's very little use when you're going to be hearing two of these people making a presentation twice, and then, of course, we want an opportunity to express, I guess, jointly with you some of the things that we have found and some of the problems that have arisen that we've kind of had a handle on. We need your wisdom in helping us prepare, and if this needs amending, at least how we should amend it to get it to do the job that we're speaking to here.
Mr. Google Chairman.
President Jones.
Now, speaking of dollar values here, I'm wondering if this is going to apply to domestic livestock, if we couldn't have this applied to numbers instead of dollars. Because it's going to take about 10 of those calves, about 20 of those calves that you had pictured there to come up to this $200 value.
You're all right on this one. See, that's automatically if I have to tell me, larceny livestock.
Except that we can't get a conviction, so.
Yeah, Representative Richardson.
You had a question for Major Hershey? First of all, Major, I want to say I'm really glad I decided to have a light lunch. there was obviously a difference.
Magruder's animals.
Yeah. Oh, good.
there's obviously a difference between some of those pictures out in the woods where there's just blatant waste and the pictures from the Russian community where the meat was cut and cured for human consumption. And my question is, do you have any idea about how much poaching may be done for family consumption or by people who are poaching to eat?
No, I'm sorry, we don't, but I can, an observation along that line. The people of the state of Oregon apparently advocate more and stronger game law enforcement than most states. I can give you a recent example. Last season, the boys' home came down and picked up two cow elk that we gave them at Jewel Meadows, shot illegally, and we always have some salvage. So this fellow came down with his family and picked up two elk in a pickup. By the time he got to Portland with them, our enforcement people had three individual calls on these illegal elk. New Mexico, and I'd be afraid to tackle that in Oregon, just completed a study. They hired a poacher, their chief of, my counterpart, the chief of enforcement, and he worked together, went out and hunted deer and other animals for a year. Killed something over 250 animals. They have pictures. They're right on the main highway with a rifle across the hood shooting antelope. Cars, it drew a crowd. It stopped, back up, watched the whole thing, antelope being shot out there, and they never received one call. They put the intros in conspicuous places. And they have a system there where everybody's supposed to report everything. Not one call on somebody butchered the deer down a block from my house. So apparently the response is different in this state than it is in New Mexico. I can't imagine, envision anybody conducting a ridiculous study like this.
You know, as I understand what you're saying in terms of the motivation for this bill, it doesn't seem to me that you're saying that the present legal treatment in terms of the statute, the classification of this kind of conduct as a Class A misdemeanor, with the escalating fine structure, doesn't seem to me you're saying that that doesn't really provide enough potential punishment for these offenses. It seems to me what you're saying is that in many cases the judiciary is just not taking this kind of conduct seriously enough in terms of the choices it makes within the authority we've given them now. Would that be a fair summary of where you're? And that part of what you're looking for here is a message to the judiciary from the legislature that we expect them to start cracking down on this.
I'm sure it should have a psychological impact on them, I would imagine. A lot of legal minds aren't necessarily familiar with the types of things we're talking about here. You don't have this mess in the courtroom, you know, it's just some guy saying how he made a mistake and all this. So, again, to many of our judges, this is just a kind of a prank or a mistake, and it's all been cooled by the time we get into the courtroom. The judges that do participate, and we have some that actually are quite enthusiastic in hunting and fishing themselves, they're not easily fooled on these things. But they all know, every judge knows the difference instantly between a felony and a misdemeanor.
The problem I have, you know, with that as the motivation for a change to Class C felony as a general matter is that, I personally don't think that a Class A misdemeanor classification is too low a classification for this. But there's ample authority given now to punish, and I wouldn't think that more than a year in jail, I don't know how you would feel, but I would think a sentence up to a year in jail for any of these offenses would be a pretty stiff sentence.
No. Granted,
so
sure.
The court really doesn't need more authority than it's got now to punish justly. Would you agree with that?
They'd exercise the existing authorities. Sure, I agree with you.
Okay. The
All
problem
the
I have,
though, when you and again, going more to the fishery side, you steal, abscond $200 worth of anything from anybody, and it's automatically a Class C felony. Yet, they could conceivably take this $10,000 worth of fish that I mentioned, that is your and my property, and wind up with a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I use as an example in talking to the judges and different ones is this, we're talking about a natural resource or a resource, and wildlife and the fish. For instance, especially the fish. Sometimes we set the limits on when they can fish, or the escapement is important. And these people who are out, they have no regard for that escapement, for the future propagation of the run. So they're going out there and they're literally stealing from the public, whether it's the buying public or the sportsmen or the people who work in the canneries or wherever it is. They're literally stealing from us the insurance that we have of continued propagation. In the wildlife thing, now, just like Major Hershey mentioned, the elk that was turned out. We had just above me, up there above Lebanon, we had a group. There was, I don't know, several head of elk turned loose in there quite a few years ago. And it was beginning to build up. And what happens? Pretty soon the bulls are all killed out of it. Well, some of us were mad enough to have gone out and taken the law in our own hands because we were watching something build up there that was really a potential. We got poachers went out there out of season, killed these animals, and now I don't think there's a single head up there. They went up there and done this. You know, it's my resource, it's your resource. And I think it's just as important that we protect those resources, even though it's not one individual. But they're out there, the pressure, the hunting pressure is getting greater, the demands on it, with more and more people participating. And you see, then the people that are buying the license, they're buying the permits, they're paying the fees, they're going out and legally doing this. They're paying for all this. They're paying for that propagation and all. And yet we have these individual poachers who go out and steal from us. And we've looked at this, whether or not, and I agree, under the existing laws, it seems to me that the judges ought to take this seriously. They ought to be taking the responsibility, but they don't seem to do it. Now, and so we have felt, okay, if we have to make them understand that we consider this as a serious matter, this is a kind of I admit that this is a kind of a tough step to go, but as we look at this, to just emphasize the seriousness of it, the people that come before me, I hear them because of our committee assignment, the bills that come to us, and the sportsman's group that come to us and talk to them. And we hear these people continually, and so this is, we get this poor, we're pretty concerned, and being a sportsman myself, it's been several years since I've killed a deer, and some of these guys have gone out there and poached my deer, you see. Well, that's all right. I still buy my license every year, and I go out because I like to grow, and I'll kill mine legally or I won't kill one. But, we're all, the rest of us, the law-abiding citizens and the rest of the citizens are being cheated out of what's theirs. And I just, it seems to be kind of a rough way to go, but I don't know what else to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Jones.
Yeah, I'd like to ask, whoever wants to answer this. Are we talking about here now a conviction, or where's the judgment going to be as far as the violation, whether it's, whether convicted of a violation? Where's the judgment going to be there? If somebody agrees, and who is this person going to be that's going to agree that a violation has been committed, then this particular wording then would apply to that. But who makes that judgment?
Well, it would be a criminal charge filed.
Yeah, but see, my point, Hardy, is that if the judge, turned him loose to keep him from coming under a class of felony, would that be up to the judge, the judgment there, as to whether he was actually violated?
Be a jury question if the defendant demanded a jury.
This is the problem, Marty. Because theoretically, then there's 1,200 cases we're talking about, and I suspect that we're really only talking about 10 or 12 of them maybe doing a little time. if any, or put on probation and have to answer to a corrections officer. But still, we'd have to proceed. We'd have to go after each one like we're prosecuting a felony. This is the problem I see with it. I was in hopes, and I understand that the district attorney does not have this authority. Here's another problem. We can go and we can sit down and discuss this with the DA. We can tell him, all right, here's the guy's rap sheet. We've had him describe the situation that he was involved in last year, the year before, and so on. In our judgment, I can envision maybe the law enforcement officer having the authority to recommend to the DA. But I would like to see the district attorney be the determining factor as to whether you proceeded on a Class D felony or a Class A misdemeanor. But I'm not so sure of the legal machinery there under existing statute that this could be done, because everything I've been able to find says the judge at the time of sentencing can make the determination whether he wants to sentence.
There are serious constitutional problems investing the district attorney, if I recall correctly, with the discretion in terms of, I think we've had decisions in Oregon on that. On that particular approach, whether the DA can charge it as one versus the other.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that's the reason for my question, whether the judge is going to, or whoever, has the
authority. Well, that's the very thing that bothers me, Representative Jones.
Would have a tendency to find him not guilty because he was going to get a Class C felony charge rather than the other one.
I think Representative Rutherford had something to...
I just wondered if the disparity in sentencing that you found, does it follow any geographical pattern?
Yes and no. One county may be pretty weak and one joining it quite severe. It fluctuates.
I should have had consistent geographic pattern. In other words, you find, as an example, in Multnomah County, they're not as interested as in other areas.
Yeah, that's true.
But in the areas outside of Multnomah County.
But it isn't like all of Western Oregon or all of Eastern Oregon. It's, it can change overnight with a different judge in a particular court. I don't know whether I'm with you here.
Do you have statistics telling what the disposition of the 1,200 cases that you had last year?
This study revealed not accurate statistics. This has been floating around, and I might take a moment to explain it. The legislature asked for this to determine the very thing you're asking about. Where are these weak courts? What's the norm? So they had the Wildlife Commission do this study. They used our record section, and it bugged me for about 2-3 days trying to figure out what happened. But we started the study on April 1st. Cases made on or after April 1st of 75. We cut it off on March 31st of 76. So we had a full year. I say we. I didn't do the study. The Wildlife Commission and our record man did. Okay, I mentioned, I know we made 12,000 plus cases, green cases a year, yet only 8,000 were reflected. And this bugged me for a while until I found out what happened. Actually, we should have cut off on March 31st and then waited another 3 months, because like making sausage, this 4,000 cases were still running around in the mill someplace and hadn't surfaced. But it did show the trend, the highs and the lows, the conversion rate of the various courts. Okay. We have that.
All right, that's what I'm wondering. Of those 8,000 cases, some of them were cases that would be covered by this, and I'd be interested to know what kinds of sentences were handed down. On the, however you have the statistics, either on the average or broken down by county or whatever, I'd be interested in
that. I'll bring copies of this study over for the committee. I'll send them over later this afternoon.
Yes, Representative Myers.
Mr. Russo says that the copy was sent to each legislator at the blueback pamphlet.
Yes, well, there was a copy sent to each legislator. However, we had some judges who wrote and said that there were some errors in that. The judge from Curry County challenged that. We responded to that. I don't know how many other errors. At least the ballpark thing And we should get that, if maybe we need to get some additional copies of that.
What is that caption? Does it have a name so I could recognize it? Might be in my office.
Wally, do you have a copy of it with you?
Report of the 77 legislature, through the 77 legislature on Clark disposition, I think the wildlife law violation. He's replaced by the Sergeant of Arms about the first week of the session.
Right.
On your desk.
So we will check. If you don't have it, we'll get additional copies up.
I know we have other witnesses, so I just summarize my concerns right now, and that is that the whatever benefit we might gain in terms of a message, I don't know to what extent that will be offset by disadvantages in this step that we've been talking about, whether it's increased difficulty of convictions, increased problems with negotiating pleas. There are trade-offs there that are hard to measure. And
I share your concerns, Mr. Chairman. I
think for myself, if we were to go to a Class C felony structure, I for one, I think it'd be more comfortable if we did it on a multiple offender, repeated offense basis, provide a step up at some point upon, you know, so many convictions.
I think those are the guys that we're after primarily anyway, I think in most cases that we would be that would be acceptable. Those are the people that usually we're not, you know, people make mistakes, but usually don't happen in this kind of, you know, this kind of cost. But it's interesting.
Well, isn't that what we do, Mr. Chairman? Isn't that what we do in Section 2?
Well, fine structure goes up. You're talking about a Class C felony.
But by finding him guilty, in other words, I see what you're saying.
Rep. Cindy Myers, your concern over the penalties. ORS 161705, dealing with authority of sentencing court. Upon conviction for a Class C felony, the judge, which would be the circuit judge, may, having concern with the, or having regard to the nature and circumstances of the crime and to the history and character of the defendant, impose a misdemeanor sentence. So if you have a person that's maybe hadn't built up too big of a record in this type of a game or face violation, he has the option to either hold for the Class C penalty or the misdemeanor.
But that discretion on the part of the judge doesn't really meet the problems I was talking about earlier that you encounter before you get to the conviction stage, the problem of perhaps increased resistance to negotiation, problem of increasing difficulty.
You would either have the indictment process or the information complaint through the district attorney's office and in preliminary hearing and so forth.
I know, that's one of the things that we've, you know, considered about this, too. The problem is, Daniel brought up, too, that you're not always sure that the judge may look at that thing and just really dismiss it. And, okay, any...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Jones.
I think we would also, of course, maybe not need to mention this, but I think also we'd run into the same proposition with juries if they had to be picked to... Depend on what kind of group you represented.
Well, yeah, I'm particularly thinking about juries in terms of the difficulty of conviction.
I'm not convinced you wouldn't go backwards rather than forwards.
Sir?
I'm not convinced you wouldn't go backwards rather than forwards in the Class C felony as far as convictions.
I'm not either.
I mean, you know what I think Representative Jones is talking about is that it's just going to be extremely difficult to get 12 people to have a jury, and if you're talking about animals, to sit down there and convict a person of a felony. And they're probably going to give what we in the legal profession call jury pardons. And that would really make you go backwards, because then the person's just off completely. And that's what I'm concerned about with the felony.
Anybody? Yes, Representative Starr. I get a
bill like this that refers to a lot of other statutes and says in lieu of and in addition to and that, and then without having all these things there, it's kind of hard to put it together. It's the same if they did have it all here and try to listen to everything it said, that would make it more difficult to do. But I've got, I don't quite understand this in section one, in this language between lines 10 and 17. And what troubles me is that I probably raised this question in the Natural Resources Committee, and I don't find any note that I'd written down that I was satisfied with any answer. So I'll probably have to start it all over again. Oh, what does all that mean, 10 through 17? And how does it relate to other parts of this bill?
Well, in the first place, I believe 161 and 635 has been renumbered.
I guess the specific question is, this language has changed in here from events that occur more than an hour prior to a season and more than an hour subsequent to a season. It's changed to include that hour, those 2 hours, and also include the season.
Is your question where the hour comes in?
Yeah, and I remember bringing this up before, and I didn't have any note of
I think Dennis has a response to that, too.
I'd like to take a stab at the answer to that question in regards, under the existing system.
Hey, Dennis, do you want to come on up so we can get the tape?
Yeah. Under the existing system, there is a series of graduated penalties for out-of-season big game violations. That's what's described here, basically, in lines 10 through 16. If you look at the old language, it's the system for big game, and it's worth more than $200. And the reason the language that this bill would delete of more than 1 hour prior or more than 1 hour subsequent described, or presently described, as a violation taking place out of season. This new language would describe a violation taking place basically within season, but allowing a 1 hour grace period on either side for the person who had his watch set wrong or whatever. And then, so that under present law, if you've got the big game out of season violation, you get the graduated penalties for multiple convictions. Under the new scheme that would be enacted by this bill, you would get the graduated scheme for in-season violations and the felony scheme for out-of-season violations.
Okay, thanks.
An in-season violation would be punishable as a Class A misdemeanor in terms of imprisonment, and subject to the graduated fine schedule that stays here, rather than the fine that's normally, or that's linked to a Class A misdemeanor under the penal code.
Exactly.
And an in-season violation would be, or rather an out-of-season violation would be a Class A felony.
Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Henry, did you get a chance to testify on this?
No, I haven't.
Henry Pavlis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Henry Pavlis of Albany, Oregon, and I'm speaking for the Northwest Two Headers Council of Crown Unlimited. We support this particular bill. We want to point out, of course, that game and fish are property of the state, and when taken illegally, they're actually stealing from the state. And our feeling is that the stealing of game and fish having a value of over $200 should correspond to all other acts of stealing. We're concerned with several aspects of this bill. One is, of course, the high incidence of poaching that's occurring, particularly the market hunters and the market fish hunters.
we're concerned with a high incidence of reoccurrences by some violators. We're concerned about the adverse effect upon the resources, and Representative Byers already touched on that, so I won't go into detail on that part of it. And, of course, the law-abiding citizen is denied the resource that is taken by the outlaws. The penalties actually have been so low that it pays to break the law. This is our concern. If penalties become a Class C felony, we believe that this will be severe enough to greatly reduce the possible 1,200 violations that was mentioned by Major Hershey. There's considerable time and money expended by state police in handling and processing these cases, and many times the cost of handling and processing these cases is many times the cost of the fines and the penalties that are levied. These are some of our real concerns. I might say that all the sportsmen organizations that I've had contact with, the individual sportsmen, feel pretty strongly that something needs to be done to rectify this severe problem that's occurring, particularly in regard to some of the species that are down in numbers. And all of them, to the best of my knowledge, those I've had contact with, indicate that they're interested in a Class C felony.
Okay, your questions of Henry. Yes, Representative Dugas. Henry,
does it bother you at all to get to that point that Representative Kulongowski made? Does it bother you that some young fellow that is on the hog line at Oregon City might be, frankly, going to law school at night and take out a half a dozen big Chinook this coming March and decide to go sell them to a restaurant over at Oregon City? Find himself in front, get caught and convicted, and find himself with a felony conviction on his record?
This does bother us, of course. It does, of course. It bothers everyone. If it's a first-time offense, but we would assume that perhaps that the courts would rule that maybe it wasn't in this particular case.
But you're taking that option away from him in this case.
Yeah. Are you?
This is my understanding, isn't it?
Well, of course, in sentence. And sentence a Class C felony as a Class A misdemeanor.
But he still must find him under, if we have
the conviction.
He has to find him guilty of a felony, does he not?
Well, that's the offense of which he would be convicted, unless there was some, you know, plea bargain.
Right, assuming, though, that he was caught and we did pass it, he would have to be convicted as a felon, even though they lightened the sentence. He would still have a felony on his record.
Now, perhaps there's some other way of handling that particular thing. It does bother us. There's no question about it. I know that the people feel very strongly about this issue because the prevalence of these violations, you've heard Major Hurston say the amount of convictions they have. And for every conviction that they get, there are probably 8 or 10 that are not caught or more.
I'm wondering if you would consider a system whereby the first offense was handled at the first time and subsequent offenses became more serious as they occurred.
That
as
is,
an alternative.
That would be a good alternative.
I think this is, I think Representative Myers, that was one of the things that he brought up here a little while ago, too, about the, you know, the habitual offender, then to, at some point along the line, we would shift gears from the Class A misdemeanor to the Class C felony if we've got these people who are continually violating. Somewhere in there we could engage in legislation. I think it would be much more acceptable to all of us, if it's going to be acceptable at all.
Henry, I hope you understand. My comments wouldn't suggest that I don't think this is important. You know I do.
Right.
I'm trying to get the same place you want to get without finding that we've created more problems than we've solved. And
I agree.
To do that in tinkering around with the penal code, I think. There's a certain ease in just shifting classifications, but I think it's more complicated than that.
I sincerely agree with that, because the last time that we testified, the last session, we didn't, our organization did not speak for Class B felony. We spoke for higher penalties, but although they did get these higher penalties into the record, they still didn't achieve it. And this was the reason why this time we decided to support the felony. But there may be other ways to achieve it. We're interested. You know what our interest is, and we're looking to you to figure out ways of resolving it for us.
Any questions of him?
Thank you.
Take care of it.
Today already. I'm glad to see the rain, but it sure kind of affected me. I slipped and fell down a while ago. My leg, I think I broke my leg over. I'm going to go in and have it x-ray after a bit, but I didn't want to miss it. Mr. Byers, the chairman, the rest of the committee. I'm the president of the United Sports of Oregon, and I'm representing the Four Corner Rod and Gun Club and the Tri-County Gun Club. It makes up, I'm representing around some 30,000 people. And the United Sports of Oregon and these two clubs, they are in great numbers when it comes to hunting and fishing. And we wish to ask the committee to put a due pass on this bill, 2096, and direct enough teeth in this bill so as to at least make believers out of all future violations. And it should be set up set up so no judge can weasel his way around handing out the necessary punishment. I've been here in over the state of Oregon, and I've been here 34 years, and you just about tell where you can go poaching, and if you get caught, you're going to get off easy. And I'm like a lot of them, I'm kind of sick of that. If a man commits a crime, he knows it's a crime, he gets caught, I think he ought to get the full effect of the penalty. If he's first time, second time, or at all, he knows it to begin with, so I don't see no excuse to let a man off the first time. We wish to see jail time and confiscation of all equipment, including a car. If you're using a car, like, see it confiscated. Make a believer, get a man in his pocketbook, I know it's going to hurt him. If we make this a felony, it would stop them at least from owning firearms, so it might help control hunting out unlawful. Federal law against any felons owning firearms, yes, sir.
I wanted to ask, when he was done with his testimony, I had a question related to the first part of it.
We would also like to see the hunting rights removed for at least 2 or 3 years if it is not a Class C felony. There are enough violations for suspension if they are caught violating the suspension, which some have been done, that they would get jail time.
Representative
Ellis. What I was trying to feel for, Mr. Shively, is what did you feel, what do you feel is a reasonable jail sentence for a first violation?
A year.
And a second and a third?
I think a year, and then on up until they send them to the pen. I have no qualms about it. I've been a lawman long years ago, and when you're wrong, you're wrong, and I still think that's the same way it should prevail today. Well, our law people are working under a handicap all the time, and the way this handicap's going to be removed is by you gentlemen right here. You go out where the Russian colony is, and you won't even see deer tracks anymore, and you won't even see any fish in the river. Of course, they're not the only ones, but that's a good example.
Any other questions of Tech? Thank you, Tech.
Thank you.
Forrest and Muret.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Committee. I'm Forrest Muret, and I'm speaking for Save Oregon Resources today. And I think you mostly already know that SORT is a organization consisting of past and present leadership of principal sports organizations in the state, and they voted unanimously to support this
2096. One thing disturbs me, it sure doesn't bother me to send a young man to jail any more than it does an old one. It bothers me very much that it's necessary to send either one of them. If it's necessary, it's just as necessary. And we have been a little too lenient. If we hadn't, maybe we wouldn't have broken our youngsters into disrespect the law to the extent that they do. I don't think we should condone it or in any way soften it just because a man's a little younger than another. I can't dig that one. First, I'd like to say that I want to thank Major Hussey for his presentation, which was as appropriate as it was depressing. Some of that's pretty bad, and we all know it goes on. And I'll make two other comments. We talk about here a fresh piece value of $200 or more. Depends on who that fish is valuable to, and the value shouldn't necessarily be determined by what it's worth to the man that posts it, but its highest value that it might have to someone else. For example, to my knowledge, there hadn't been a study done about 10 or 12 years ago, or even 13, on the cost of the sports-caught salmon or steelhead. I think at that time, Oregon State College or University said it was worth, it said $74 in 1 week's time spent in pursuit of each salmon or steelhead that was caught. Surely that figure, both the hours required to catch that fish and the money spent to catch that fish, both increased maybe at least twice. And this could very well make one of those fish worth $200. And I don't want to construe that I'm suggesting that we charge a sport from one price and somebody else another. Charge whoever takes the fish at its highest possible value. Or other game, anything. And the other thing I observe here that I think could be improved, I don't understand why a sportsman has to keep his watch within 1 hour of accurate. I think it'd be better if it were 5 minutes. But, and a commercial poacher could be allowed 12 hours discrepancy in his time setting. That's once around the clock. And surely anybody, keep better track of time than that. And he's poaching more fish. He'd get a boatload in that hour before the season opened sometime. I think we should straighten out that discrepancy. I'll not take any more time, I think, all the and to this thing is obvious other than those few things. To the rest of you, they are to me. I thank you unless there are some questions on all of them.
Any questions or comments? Yeah. Yes, but I'll do this.
You suggest, Forrest, that we take the top economic estimated value of that fish to the state of Oregon, taking into account all the economic value of going out and catching it and everything else. As I understand.
I'm really asking that we get the highest figure we can justify in any way, and that would probably be it.
You know, it may be as high as $75 a fish.
Yeah, I hope we can get it up to 200, so it only takes one fish.
Any other questions? Thank you, Forrest.
Yeah, I've got old one.
Reverend Starr.
Forrest, did not. You wondered why we had why this bill has this 12-hour grace period on the fish section of the bill, and I wonder that too. And what would your suggestion be that
maybe made you conform with the other, or you didn't even like the hour.
That's right. I think an hour is too long for anybody if they make that much of a mistake.
You think they probably conformed the two things, whatever?
They should be identical, and
whatever was decided was fair and equitable or reasonable, you might say.
It's easy to have a watch off 5 minutes, an hour is
pretty
bad.
Well, I tend to think so, too. Anybody should be able to tell time.
That lies of the honest man to do it the way they put it.
Yeah.
To allow that.
I think we saw in one of the slides there what an hour of it is worth $1,000 to one person.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, the honest guys get to spend letters all the time anyway. You know? I don't care what it is. It
doesn't mean we like it.
Doesn't it? Just because you're getting it doesn't mean you have to like it. Right? Okay. Thank you for it. Raleigh, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yes, sir. Quick comment, Mr. Chairman.
I'm Raleigh Russo, representing the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Apologize for being late, but I know that Major Hershey basically covered the area for both agencies of our concern, and this bill was introduced at the request of our department. I won't go into detail. We do have a statement that I'll give to your clerk, and they can make it available to you. I will also get some extra copies of this and make that available. And I think that some of the concern expressed by the committee is one that we're concerned with, too, is the fact that we don't want to move two steps backwards with something we're moving forward with. And for that reason, we'd be very pleased to work with you to assure that that isn't the case if this measure is to pass or be modified in some form. Thank you.
I'd just like to ask one question. Has anything been done? You've heard some of the objections on that on the report there, I presume. Has there been anything done to make the corrections or update that? I had some explanation on it. It's foggy in my mind at this point what the explanation was that where the mistakes were in.
No, we have, not to my knowledge, have made any errata sheet, if that's what you're asking. We have responded to some of the people who have written us and responded to their letters pointing out some of the problem. But we have not made any changes.
Okay, basically, though, this will give them a pretty good perspective on how the cases have been handled. And I have to admit that my county, Linn County, has got the worst record in the whole damn bunch. You know, and I'm not proud of that. But that's in fact, I will have to say that the meeting we held, I attended down in Cottage Grove. One of the few people that didn't have any comment of the 60-some judges in attendance, the judge from my county didn't have a word to say. You know, I don't think he's improved after that meeting either. So, okay, there goes Myers.
Does the penal code now make it unlawful for the hotels and others to buy fish taken in violation of the fish and game laws? I assume it does.
Yes, that's my understanding. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you filing any charges against those
kinds of?
Yes, sir. Are you getting convictions?
Yes, sir.
Anything else? Any questions, Roy?
Yeah. I think we're going to start. The status of this bill is that it's in the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee now, a subsequent referral to Judiciary.
That's right.
And the next action is going to occur, if any, is in the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee.
We have to.
The question that's kind of important is what Raleigh just offered to do would be to come up with some maybe different language so it didn't take a chance on losing any ground by not having the right language in it. Would it be appropriate for him to bring that to the Ag Committee, or?
I think we would, Representative, I think that we would like to have it before we refer it to the Judiciary Committee as clean as possible,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, they got a workload here that I can see the book, and so we would like to do as much as we could for it in the Ag Committee before we come over here, because undoubtedly they're going to find some things that they need to do anyway. But if we could help clarify some of these things, there's something we can do to make it more palatable. Some of the members over here before they were too
big. Representative Byers, or Mr. Starr, although we surely will work with you to work out the language, I really perhaps was suggesting that I think there's some talent on the committee
from a legal standpoint, and particularly in the judiciary system, that perhaps we do not have a good enough feel for and maybe aren't in the best position to amend it to correct those situations. I'm not wondering if...
Maybe judiciary is the right committee.
Right.
I just know their load is heavy, and I thought if anything we could do would be, not that ours isn't getting that way, but nonetheless, well, at least we can work it out between the two committees. Any other questions?
Thank you,
Roy. Was anyone else that hasn't signed up on this, that had anything to add? Certainly, at this point, if there's something that hasn't been said, if someone desires to speak on it while we're here, otherwise we're going to call this session closed. No one else?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I do think it's